New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today I have a very special guest, a dear old friend, somebody I've known for decades, somebody I've actually wanted to interview for decades, Patricia Fripp. Patricia is a legendary person in her own right. I remember back in the days when I lived in San Francisco driving down Highway 101, there would be a huge billboard with her picture reclining, if I remember correctly. Patricia, how I know Patricia is because she's the founder of the San Francisco chapter of the National Speakers Association, and she is a speaker of legend all over the world. The chapter gives out its annual Patricia Fripp Award. So when you have an award named after you, I think one could say you've arrived. And I'm so delighted, Patricia, that you've arrived here in Albuquerque so that I can interview you in our little studio. And Patricia is also well known as the sister of the legendary rock musician, her brother, Robert Fripp. And, well, there's so much more I could say. She began with humble beginnings. Her career started as a hairdresser in San Francisco. And even before that, lived in a haunted house with her brother. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It is a pleasure to be in your modest studio in your spectacular home.
Well, I'm so delighted to be with you. I know we've talked about doing an interview long, long ago, and it's a pleasure for me to share a dear friend with the New Thinking Aloud audience. I should also say, I really need to say, I owe you a debt of gratitude for helping me with the award acceptance speech at the Bigelow Institute competition. And I'm so glad you were there with me.
It is so exciting anytime you have some help with the presentation to sit and listen to it being delivered. Of course, in that circumstance, it was so exciting and a memorable experience.
Yes, and in fact, the speech that you helped me craft won an award, as I recall, as the best award acceptance speech.
Well, I did submit it to the Professional Speechwriters Association, and in the category of acceptance speeches, yes, a Cicero Speechwriting Award was sent to me.
That's another reason that I'm grateful to have you as a friend. Well, what I didn't say for our viewers is that you're renowned in so many different ways, but I think one of them is certainly that you are a coach for other professional speakers. You are a speaking coach, and although you started life, I think it would be fair to say, with humble beginnings, you are a master of diction, and I'm sure you could correct my diction.
No, I was a young girl because our story, of course, begins in a small town in England. And to put this into context, to help our listeners understand, my mother was a coal miner's daughter in South Wales, and at age 18 was smart enough to know there is nothing for me here. I have to leave home. My father, who was the eldest of six and a very bright young man, was born with polio. He had polio in his mother's womb, which, of course, wouldn't happen now, but years ago. Yeah. So consequently, he could never serve in the military. So when my parents got married in 1939 at the beginning of World War II, and he was a realtor, well, nobody buys homes when they're dropping bombs. So my mother became the major breadwinner. However, I was born at the end of the war. And although I would say, yes, both the beginnings were humble, they worked very hard to elevate themselves. Mm-hmm. And I would give good credit to the British educational system, because I left school 10 days before my 15th birthday to serve an apprenticeship. And my father would never believe that I now put the words in executives' mouths. And I would say to all parents, if you want your children to have a good start in life, help them understand the importance that language makes. My mother told me stories about how Winston Churchill would get on the radio and with the power of his words would inspire the nation to have hope and be prepared to experience any hardship that would be necessary. So when I was growing up, and I only realized this as I matured, England, for all the time I lived there, because I left home to come to America at 20, was still suffering from the expense of World War II.
England was devastated with the German bombing campaign.
So when I was born, my parents were living above my father's business premises. And, of course, as soon as there was a second baby, and my brother, who grew up to be an internationally acclaimed rock and roll guitarist, Robert Fripp, he is 1 year, 1 month, 2 days, 12 and a half hours younger than I am. And with two babies, they had to move. So that is where your story really begins, because it was a haunted house.
How interesting. I just interviewed your friend, my friend, Terry Rock. And I mentioned to him, I said, did you know Patricia lived in a haunted house? And Terry's a bit of a skeptic. And he says, well, what does that mean? What do you actually mean by a haunted house?
Well, I can tell you, because my brother and I were very young. We just knew, and I think we shared a bedroom because we knew there was something strange about it. It's as if there was somebody visiting us in the night. Not that it talked to us, but we were aware of. And again, what we found out, because when in the war, the army would come over and take over rooms in your house. For example, in the business premises, the army came in and took one of my father's two offices as the pay office for the soldiers and took over their big sitting room to house 13 soldiers. And so there had been American soldiers in this house that had come to help us out. And one black American soldier had hung himself in the upstairs toilet.
Oh, my.
And of course, in later life, as we matured, our parents told us all the stories. They had at least six different times plumbers come in because the lavatory chain would pull itself and nobody was using the bathroom. The amount of times that they continued to try and fix this problem that never went away. My mother tells a story about how several times she would hear Dad's car come in the evening and crunch over the gravel, and she'd run to the back door. And Father hadn't driven in, but she'd heard it. My mother would always kiss my father on the top of his head if she came in from a meeting. And this one day, My father was watching, was reading, whatever he was doing, because that was before television. And we were, of course, the first family in the town to have a television, but this was before television. My father would have been reading or listening to the radio in the sitting room, and he heard mother come in from her meeting, and she didn't come kiss him on the head. He heard her walk upstairs, and he thought, oh, she's going to check on the children before she comes in. He heard the lavatory chain pull. Heard her come downstairs. She didn't come in, which was so strange. He went out to look. And then an hour later, she came in. And he said, did you come in and go out? And she said, no, I've just come home. Now, when they left that house, well, I was about 6 or 7. My father said to my mother, I never wanted to tell you, but that house was haunted. She said, I knew. I never told you I thought it was, because I thought you would think I was crazy. But so all of us had a different experience. And we do believe it was the American soldier. Mm. He never left the house.
But it's interesting. Here you are, an intimate family situation where you're afraid to tell each other what you all know.
That is very strange, because probably my father must have known, because there was only one other owner before us. And probably they might have had a challenge selling it because it was known that the soldier had hung himself in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And my father would have been a man who was looking for a good deal. And he probably thought Edie wouldn't move there if she knew it was haunted. Now, people don't realize, but the part of the world that we live in the south of England, it is the highest percentage of sightings of UFOs.
I did know.
Oh, yes. And because my brother, who grew up and has bought multiple houses himself that he's lived in, and he always buys houses which were built in the 1600s or the 1700s. And I said, brother, why do you buy such old houses? And he says, it's the only way you can get an established garden. Well, that was his answer. I don't know if it's true. However, we always like, in England, you like antiques. You like tradition. You like, or many of us like what is old and has a history. And of course, if you buy a house that has been in existence for hundreds of years, a lot has happened in the house. A lot of people have died. And one of the homes that brother bought, this was before he got married, and this was an old house. It was magnificent. And in the past, there had been a family that had a child that was probably mentally retarded. People didn't know in those days really what was wrong. They just knew this something was wrong. And unfortunately, their habit, there was no way they could have got help in those days. They would keep the child in a room, and as far as the outside world knew, they didn't really exist. Well, there had been a child in this house who lived their entire life in this room. And when they died, there was definitely a presence. When my brother bought this house, now you understand, to my brother, this was fascinating. This would make it more interesting, whereas it might put some people off. And they knocked down this room because he had a circular staircase put in. But they always knew there was a presence in that house. And there was one time I was visiting, and my brother was out. He was out with some friends. And I was a little tired. I just lay down on the sofa, and I was at the state, Jeffrey, that I wasn't 100% asleep, but I was close enough to sleep that when I heard my brother open the door and say, oh, sister's here, she's having a sleep, let's go, we'll talk to her later. And then I must have gone to sleep. Well, I got up, and then my brother came in about an hour after I woke up, said, did you come in earlier? And he said, no. But I vividly, you can say, oh, you were asleep, you're dreaming it. I do not believe that. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that. But I never slept in the house ever again. I would visit, but I wouldn't sleep overnight. Now, the house and when he was having work done on the house, one of the workmen was in the toilet upstairs. And his mates were, you know, rattling the door handle and shouting abuse at him and, you know, making fun. And he said, oh, go away, you guys, go away. And then when he went down, he said, why were you making such a fuss when I was in the toilet? And they said, what do you mean? We've been out here eating lunch. So there were enough of those situations. You can say one, oh, you were asleep, sister, you were asleep. Well, there were too many of these stories. And in England, there are so many homes. It's not considered a little strange and wacky the way it might be perhaps in America, which really isn't old. Yeah. It wasn't old. The church where I was confirmed in England was built in 10-something. Mm. I was visiting England last year and I went to a magnificent cathedral that was built in 700. Well, so many stories, so many situations. And the house that my brother and his wife live in now were filmed for, there's a TV show in England about haunted houses. Mm-hmm. And apparently the situations in their houses are the scariest of any in the show. My sister-in-law, who's a very famous actress and singer, Toya Wilcox, she is more open. I would say, I won't say dead people. She talks to dead people. However, she's very aware and sensitive and sees and hears what the average might not.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have described your relationship with your brother, a famous musician, yeah, also as that he's your soulmate.
Well, yeah. Well, as little children, being 1 year, 1 month, 2 days, 12 and a half hours apart, my mother, and British people are very practical, my mother realized that little children, you know, you two, you three, you four, you don't understand why your brother or sister would get presents and you don't have any. For many years, we celebrated our birthdays on my birthday in April, his was May, because we would understand. And brother, when he was young, you know, little, as the most articulate person I've ever met now, the way he spoke, I don't know if it's something to do with his teeth coming in. I was the only one who could understand what he was saying. And being two children close to the same age, I think it's different if you're 4 or 5 years apart. Oh, you know, take your brother or sister with you. We played together. We had this game called Dinky Donks, which we would make up these stories and have little characters and make little plasticine downs. And when we were quite young, I know we said to mother, oh, you know, we're going to get married when we grow older. And mother said, brothers and sisters don't get married. We said, that's most unfair. We'll never love anyone the way we love each other. We'll live together when we're old, which... Anyway, as it happened, we grew up and, of course, had many romances ourselves. And a brother met the woman he recognized as the woman he's going to marry and proposed within a week, which, interestingly enough, so did my father, who was a staunch bachelor. When he met my mother, she'd proposed on the second date.
Do you think you might have a telepathic relationship with your brother?
I had never thought of it that way. However, we have a strong support system. Mm-hmm. There are some topics about families or losing our parents we could only really talk to about each other. Once or twice my brothers had challenges and he would find it easier to talk to me than perhaps tell his wife.
I wonder, hypothetically, yeah, if something were to happen to him, he's now 6,000 miles yes away, you might know if something happened to him, if he were in, trouble of some sort, you'd have an instinct about it.
I probably would agree that might happen. Okay. I don't say it has happened, but it might happen.
I just wonder because the sensitivity to a presence in the house, a haunting, suggests that in the family there was kind of an openness to this sort of thing. Some people wouldn't be sensitive to it at all.
I would definitely say that our family would be open to it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your brother and his career. Yeah. He was known, if I recall correctly, King Crimson.
Yes. Well, yeah, King Crimson was his first band. And interestingly enough, and as we grow up, and we talk on a very regular basis, multiple times a week, we have found there have been dates and times when our careers have matched or situations in our lives. For example, King Crimson was born on January the 13th. I emigrated to America on January the 13th. You know, there's always publicity and social media presence about this is the anniversary of King Crimson being born. So I celebrate January the 18th, the day I got off the boat in New York. So, and various situations that we talk about, I said, well, that's the day I did this, or connections. But King Crimson was born. Now, it might interest you to know that the first live performance of King Crimson was in the Speakeasy Club, which was also known as the Speak Coarsely and Loudly Club. This was an industry watering hole. There were, where they performed, about 100 people. However, as these were industry, people in the music industry, because they did well, they were influencing the influencers. That meant that their career went, it began faster. And interestingly enough, David Bowie was there and walked over and asked a young lady to dance. Now, King Crimson music, if anyone's familiar with King Crimson, you don't think of this as dancing to music. However, that was David Bowie's first wife. Later that summer, because of influencing the influencers, they had the opportunity to open for the Rolling Stones. There were several other acts. They were one of them for a free concert in Hyde Park. And although nobody knows exactly how many people that were there, it's estimated 650,000 people. And because King Crimson did well, they were open to opportunity to perform internationally in Europe, in America. And because many people had come from all these places to see the Rolling Stones, when they went to Europe, when they came to America, there were enough people that said, hey, you got to come with me to see this band. So that first performance at the Speakeasy launched them as far as England was concerned. With the Rolling Stones later that year, it gave them the international opportunity. And that's how it began. Now, there are many hard, hard years.
As I recall, Rolling Stone magazine listed him as one of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time.
The 42nd guitarist in the history of the world, living or dead. Jimi Hendrix was number one. Now, in other lists, you see him higher up. It all depends. Now, it might interest you to know in this story is King Crimson was having their 50th anniversary tour. And my brother, who didn't at the time normally talk to the press, realized we got to have a press conference. So they had beautiful club in London, and people, press came from all over. And the editor of the Rolling Stone came over from New York to London, and he asked my brother this question: what is the purpose of the King Crimson 50th anniversary tour? And my brother said, to introduce King Crimson to innocent ears.
To innocent ears.
Because anytime you go to any of their events, and now he is lecturing, I was just doing the merchandise at some of his speaking events with his business partner, David Singleton, they've had fans that followed them for decades. Yeah. He obviously realized there are a lot of fans who were coming in a lot younger who would appreciate the music, and this is true with all bands. And they took different choices. You go to King Crimson concert, you don't have flashlights, you don't take pictures till the end.
It's not conventional rock and roll.
But it's so complicated music, and the musicians play in different time frames that you really don't want the distractions. You wait, we'll take your photographs, you take ours. So they took different choices. They went to Rock and Rio, 100,000 people, and it's all video and photos. However, they introduced King Crimson to innocent ears. So there are a lot more 20, 30-year-olds that discovered King Crimson.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the name King Crimson. It sort of evokes the idea of the devil. The devil is sometimes portrayed in red.
Well, I wouldn't say that. And I did ask my brother, and I can't exactly remember the answer to how they came up with that name, but it wasn't that complicated. However, anyone who's familiar with King Crimson, in the Court of the Crimson King was their first album. Yeah. And the Schizoid Face, because one of their famous songs is 21st Century Schizoid Man. And the face, the front and the back, it's very strange and weird. Mm. So you might think of that as having strange. Now, I wouldn't say the devil, but it's very strange. The Schizoid Face is very famous. And the young man who created that album cover was not an artist, but he created it, and he died very young. It was the only piece of art he ever created.
Let's talk about your life when you came to the United States. You began your career as a hairdresser.
Well, I served a three-year apprenticeship to be a hairstylist at 15. And I had the idea through a girlfriend. She said, she was a little older than I was, and she said, I have a pen pal in America. I'm going to go see her. And I said, wait till I finish my apprenticeship and I'll come with you. Well, as fate would have it, we went on a double date and she married her date. So the idea of going to America went out. So I went to live on an island off France called Jersey, the Channel Islands, for 2.5 years. And then it was in the back of my mind, where the kids all talked about. They never talked about when should we go home. It's where should we go next? And for me, the back of my mind was always America. And I went home for a couple of months. The idea was to go get my visa, come to America. Now, Jeffrey, I was 20 years old. I had only ever met two people who'd been to America. America was really an idea for people in England. As I say, when I came over, we're still recovering from World War II. There were not cheap vacations to Florida that people went on. We knew it by the movies. So it was an idea more than anyway.
I recall being in England early in my life, probably a little after that. Mm-hmm. But I do recall the American dollar went very far in England in those days.
Yeah. It was destiny that I come to America. And I tell you how I know that. I knew nothing. I just knew I applied. I went to the American embassy and I filled in a form that was no to everything except could you support yourself. And in my town of Wimborne, there had been a very, rather the only vaguely celebrity creative hairstylist in that town, Terry. And Terry had left and gone to Canada. And then he'd gone down to California Los Angeles to visit his sister. However, he wasn't there legally, and so he couldn't get the good job he was capable of having. So he went back to England to get his visa. And we met at a Christmas party. And I said, well, I'm going over in a couple of weeks. And he said, oh, I'm going to go get my visa, and I'll see you there in a couple of months. He did not know, and I did not know, the week after I got my visa, they changed all the rules, and I would never have got in. You had to have a definite job to come to. Well, it's very difficult to find. There are no hairdressers in America. Two, you have to have a relation who's an American citizen. Well, Terry's sister was married to an American, but she wasn't a citizen. It took him 18 months to get a job through the Hairdresser Journal, to work a two-year contract in Houston. It took him over 3.5 years to get back to where he began. And by then, So I think I didn't know, but it was destined that I'd come to America. Or I wouldn't have made it the week before they changed the rules and I wouldn't have got in. And of course, I didn't know I would stay here forever. You're 20 years old. You know, it's an adventure. And even though I'm very close to my family, even though, you know, I call home every week, it never occurred to me anything would ever go wrong, and it didn't.
But that's a huge decision to cross the ocean like that.
Well, now I look back, I said to my mother once, it was really nice you and Daddy let me go. Because at that point in England, I came 4 months before my 21st birthday. If my parents had said, you can go, but not till after you're 21, I would have done that. In those days, we listened to our parents. And then I probably wouldn't have got here. So I was destined. At that point in England in the 60s, nobody had expectations of girls. I think of my friends, my dad's friends in the Rotary Club. It would never have occurred to them their daughters could take over their business and run it better than the sons, many of whom would have been better. Mm-hmm. So for me, to come to be 6,000 miles away from home, it gave me the opportunity to live up to my potential. I don't believe the opportunities wouldn't have happened if I'd stayed in England. I'm sure I would have been successful in some way, but it would not have been the same as coming mm-hmm. to America.
Well, and even here, I mean, growing up as the firstborn son myself in a Jewish family, I know male privilege still exists. Yeah. So if I remember rightly, you at one point ran the salon at one of the major hotels in San Francisco.
Well, no, not exactly. When I got off the boat and I came out to San Francisco, I had the opportunity. My father said, you have to write to some salons. And I had one of the two people I'd met who'd been to America was the daughter of one of my hairstyling clients in Jersey. And she gave me the name of four salons in San Francisco. I wrote to them all. And one of them, Charles, who ran the beauty salon at the Mark Hopkins Hotel, wrote to me and said, I can't promise you a job, but come see me. So I went to see him as soon as I arrived. And he took me to beauty school where I got my license. And then I worked for him. And what was great about that, because I didn't know anybody. And so I had nobody to build a clientele on. However, in a hotel, of course, you have people from all over the country, all over the world. So it was a great education.
The Mark Hopkins yes. is right at the top of Nob Hill
yes.
in San Francisco, across from Grace Cathedral. It is the epitome of upper class life
yes,
in San
exactly.
Francisco.
And we had a lot of very rich women and some men. Cyril Magnin lived in apartments in the Mark Hopkins Hotel. And at that time, it was owned by Gene Autry. Now, Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, my dad had taken my brother and me to see movies. So that was exciting. Because in England, I like to say, we believed everyone in America was rich and the streets were paved with movie stars. So, of course, I remember seeing Gene Autry in the coffee shop. And his cousin was the hotel manager who was married to a woman called Pamela Britton. Pamela Britton was quite a successful actress. She was in a couple of movies with Ronald Reagan, and she was in a very popular TV show with Roy Walton, Bill Bixby, called My Favorite Martian. She was Mrs. Brown, the lady next door. She was also in a movie that became a cult movie, If It's Tuesday, It Must Be Belgium, which was a takeoff on the trips to Europe when you go to a different country every day. And I used to do her hair, and of course she would tell me all these stories about Hollywood, which was wonderful. And I did Ann Landers hair, Hayley Mills, Rosalind Russell, Princess Anne from Denmark, because she asked for me because I was British, which was wonderful. So it was a great education. And then I got the opportunity to talk my way into working at the first fancy men's hairstyling salon in San Francisco when men's hairstyling was a new industry that was taken over by Jay Sebring, the Hollywood hairstylist. Jay Sebring really created men's hairstyling, did all the movie stars' hair. I'd pick up the phone. Oh, this is Steve McQueen. Can Jay go racing with me tomorrow? I'd have to cancel his appointments.
Yeah, I remember when all of a sudden men started blow drying.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was amazing. My clients who were the movers and shakers in the financial district used to say, oh, we were at a dinner party last week and all the men were talking about the hairstyle, not the wife, much to the amusement of all their wives. And that was a very exciting time. Our opening salon party, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward came up, Warren Beatty, Julie Christie, the English actress, came to our opening party. And then, of course, one morning, you know, just started as an ordinary Saturday morning. And my best friend, Frankie, who worked in the next booth, we used to go to breakfast and drive to work in his 1960 Falcon. I used to drive, he'd look out the window. It took two of us to drive this car. And the executives, who now, of course, would probably wear jeans to their office, they only in those days would wear jeans at weekends when they went to catch up. But we were, it was fun working in the financial district on a Saturday, a lot more casual. And I was in my second haircut. The phone rang and I picked it up. And it was my friend George Schaefer Jr., who worked in a radio station in Ukiah. Well, you know Ukiah. It must have been a very small radio station. Yeah. But he said, have you heard the news? I said, what news? And he said, about your boss. I said, what about my boss? And when he told me, I hung up and I called the, I said, guys, let's go to the back. Because the night before, because Jay Sebring had a home in, obviously, in Los Angeles, but he was staying on a houseboat in Sausalito and would come up to the salon to launch it every week. And the night before, and these were very chauvinistic times, and I was the only woman in the salon, and we would stand at the edge of our booths and shake hands with Mr. Sebring. And my friend Frankie had given Jay Sebring a mug with Mr. Sebring gold sandblast and gold leafed in. And I shook hands, and he, for the first time, he kissed me on the cheek and said, you are doing terrific haircuts. Now, that's like being acknowledged by God in my world. And he said to Frankie, look after my mug till I come back on Monday. And the news that I got from George Schaefer Jr. that I shared with my teammates was the night before Jay Sebring had been murdered with Sharon Tate, and Abigail Folger and her boyfriend Farowski and Stephen.
The Manson murders.
Yes. So we found out later it was the Manson murders. Oh. Yeah. So that was the news. So it began as a very ordinary day, Jeffrey, one of our favorite Saturdays. At the end of the day, we would not have another normal day for at least a year. Mm. Now, if we fast forward a few years, this is a story that might interest you. I have a friend we just lost, Larry Wild. Larry Wild was a successful, what you might consider, second-tier opening act comedian. He opened for Sonny and Cher and Debbie Reynolds, Steve Lawrence. So he was successful, but he was also a superb writer. And he'd written a great book, What the Great Comedians Say About Comedy, What the Great Screenwriters Say About Comedy. And there was very popular for a long time, the Italian joke book, the nerd joke book, all these he created. And he joined the National Speakers Association when somebody had given him an article where Bert Decker and I were interviewed about the speaking business when we began the chapter. Mm-hmm. He came down anyway, and we became friends. And anyway, to cut a long story short, Larry Wild and his wonderful wife, Mary, had met in Albertson's supermarket in Los Angeles. They got married in Albertson's supermarket in Los Angeles on a Saturday, you know, and one of their friends who married them, you know, was really a screenwriter with a certificate who declared them two for the price of one. And this was so funny. And years after, they went back, and some women who still work, they remembered them from that, because it's a great way to get publicity for a comedian. Mm-hmm. Well, Mary and Larry had always told me about their friends, Brad and Janine. Brad had been president of the Screenwriters Guild a couple of times. He'd written 300 movies, TV shows. And his wife, Janine, was a successful, you'd say, second-tier actress. Mm-hmm. And she, it was Petticoat Junction, the TV show. And she got the job because Jay Sebring, who was engaged to Sharon Tate, and then she married someone else, but they're still very, very close, had suggested that she need to pose nude in Playboy. It would be good for her career. Well, some of these TV shows that were more family friendly. So Janine got the job because Sharon got fired because she posed naked. Just aside. Anyway. I don't know if this would be 15 years ago, might be 20. It seems to me as recent, but it is a while. And he said, you got to drive down from San Francisco. We're going to have this great party and very interesting people. And you're going to finally meet Brad and Janine, we keep telling you about. Well, I worked around my way talking to most people, and I talked to Janine, and my favorite question, I've asked it of you and Janine, how'd you meet and fall in love? Yes. And she said, the first time Brad and I met, I don't remember, but he remembers me. He was married. And then the second time they met, he was divorced, and they went out and found one. And then, as what often happens, you have this wonderful party and experience, and then most people go, and a couple of friends who are close to the hosts are still there. So it was Mary and Larry, Brad and Janine, who were staying in their guest house, me, and a gentleman called Mark, who was an NSA, National Speakers Association, Northern California member. And that afternoon, he had told me his mother had been an actress. In fact, his mother's hand was the one that did the stabbing in...
Psycho.
Yes! I mean, just trivia to add to the story. You cannot miss this story. And we were sitting around, and then I finally pushed myself up. Said, where's the long drive home? I better go. And Brad said, before you go, I haven't had the opportunity to talk to you much. Will you please give me a snapshot of your life? I said, born in England, came to America, worked at Mark Hopkins, worked for Jay Sebring. One night he kissed me on the cheek. And Brad said, stop there. He said, that night was my second date with Janine. And we were driving, and a car jumped a stoplight in front of us. And I said to Janine, those teenagers are high on drugs. They've been involved in a crime because they're covered in blood. Now, in 1969, there are no cell phones. They drove to a call box. He said, this is who I am. This is what we saw. This is the number, the license plate on the car. The next weekend, the Manson family went out and killed the LaBiancas. 8 months later, probably they caught them. Years later, Brad said he was writing, somebody was writing a screenplay about that night. Yeah. And doing the research, he went to the police station and in the old log found the report of his call, never followed up. And then Larry Wilde leaned forward and said, Patricia, do you remember I told you at that time I lived 2 doors from Sharon Tate? So you have 3 people with some connection to the same night, and none of us would know if Brad had not said, can you give me a snapshot of your life? And that is such a wonderful question. Whenever I have a new executive coaching client, I always say, let's begin. Please give me a snapshot of your life. For me, I'm looking for stories and situations and changes that can be stories that can go into their presentations.
That's very powerful. And you're connected in a synchronistic way with a horrible event, yeah. But it led to good things for the rest of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we could go on.
we could go on for a long time, but I don't want to detain you because I know you have another meeting coming up.
Well, give me one more question, Jeffrey.
How did you begin as a speaker?
Traveling nationwide for a hair product company for the person who took over the Sebring Empire, Jim Markham. And then my executive clients knew I was speaking, giving seminars for hairstylists, said, hey, come speak to my Rotary Cup Kiwanis Club Breakfast Club. In fact, as you know, I am the president of the Golden Gate Breakfast Club. Janelle is an active and excited member of the Golden Gate Breakfast Club, having been a speaker for us. And that was the first group I spoke to outside of hairstyling because my client, the wonderful Al Stanton, said, hey, come give a talk to the Breakfast Club.
And I just spoke there at your invitation 3 weeks
ago. Yes, exactly. Everything is connected.
Everything is connected. That is a wonderful lesson. It's quite amazing, though, how far you've come in the speaker's world from starting out as a hairdresser to become a person of enormous worldwide renown in that field.
And all I would say is, I can't say it's brilliant planning. It's taking advantage of opportunity, because opportunity does not knock once. It knocks all the time. We don't always recognize the sound. Perhaps, Jeffrey, just as we began our conversation, there are connections beyond what we understand.
Invisible presences.
Yes.
I would agree. Well, Patricia, I'm so honored to be able finally to have this conversation with you. It's been an absolute joy and a delight. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I hope it'll be interest to your legions of fans.
I suspect it will be of interest to your legion of fans as well. People who know you as a great professional speaker probably have never heard about the haunted house.
Well, that's true. That's true. Perhaps we are both introducing our fans to, we're introducing our messages to innocent ears. Your fans and my fans.
Thanks to your brother for the phrase.
Yes. Yes.
Well, once again, thank you so much for being with me. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.